Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Dervil MacDonald sitting in for Brendan this morning, and Brendan must be a very happy man this weekend, no doubt, after yesterday's fantastic win by Munster over Stormers in the United Rugby Championship final. Well done to all. Before I introduce you to our panel, who've been working away this morning, picking out the top stories and analysis, let's have a look at what is making the headlines in this morning's papers. Shortage of critical drugs is the worst yet, is the lead in the Sunday Times, which reports that more than 300 items are out of stock, as pharmacists say they are seeing shortages that far exceed the official statistics. We're on edge. You can imagine how the patients feel, one GP told the Times, which says that treatments that are frequently in short supply include medications for epilepsy, anxiety and fertility. The Times has a fabulous front page picture of 2-year-old Charlotte Early tackling a melting ice cream on Portmarnock Beach yesterday. Charlotte is in her absolute bliss as the ice cream melts all over her arms and legs and face. It's an absolutely brilliant snap by Sam Bowell. Soaring numbers in receipt of emergency state help is the Sunday Independent's lead. There'll be more than 180,000 claims for emergency assistance to cover basic necessities such as food, electricity and heating. The Sunday Independent reports a third of the claims have not been paid out, with more than 21,000 applications for help refused and many more withdrawn or cancelled because welfare officers do not have enough information to process the claims. Name Our Son's Killer is the lead in the Irish Mail on Sunday, as the family of Cameron Blair, who's now a 20-year-old killer who has been jailed for life, he has not been named as he was a minor at the time of the offence. For the Business Post, it's yet another poll suggesting yet another boost for Sinn Féin. Another question asked of more than 1,000 people polled online by Red Sea suggests concern about the rising numbers of refugees from Ukraine and other countries. Looking across to the tabloids, Nicola Tallant in the Sunday World leads with US cops trace Dan to Iran. And Nicola reports that officers from America's Drug Enforcement Agency, who've been following the trail of wealth of the Kinahan organised crime group, have discovered how they used a tiny island off Iran to wash and move their dirty money. Daniel's Treasure Island is a headline for a two-page spread on the activities of Daniel Kinahan on Kish, Iran's Costa del Sol, not to be confused with Kish, just off Dublin Bay. The Irish Sunday Mirror features a page one appeal by the family of Jasmine McMonagall, a young woman who was strangled to death by her former partner. They've appealed for tougher sentencing after her killer was jailed for 14 years. Phil Lied to Me is the headline in the Irish Sun on Sunday, which leads, as most tabloids do this morning, with the Philip Schofield controversy fallout, with all titles speculating if the flagship This Morning programme on ITV, fronted by Schofield and Holly Willoughby, will now face the axe. And across the IRC, the fallout of the controversy continues unabated, with many UK papers covering yesterday's statement by his This Morning co-host Holly Willoughby, who said Schofield had lied to her in denying his affair with a young male employee. Willoughby is pictured on the front page of the Sunday Telegraph, which carries her statement that the lies were very hurtful, as pressure continues to grow on IT executives over the scandal. And we may get to that story later on. But first of all, let me introduce you to our panel who've been poring over all of the paper. We've David Higgins, economist at Carraghill, Grainne Nay, reporter with the Dublin with the Press Association, Louise Bayliss, campaign coordinator of Focus Ireland and founding member of Spark, and Mick Clifford, special correspondent for the Irish Examiner. Mick, I might just start for you the week that was, the anatomy of a spat. I don't know if it would win a Palme d'Or at Cannes, but there's certainly plenty of drama in there. Can you talk us through the week, just for those who may have escaped all the travails?
Well, it was a week of throwing shapes. You know, we obviously the thing was dominated by this editorial by three junior ministers in the Irish Independent, laying out their plans for a tax package that would benefit to 1,000 euro middle income earners. And then we had the reaction from Fianna Fáil, which was nothing to do with the measure itself, but to do with the fact that this was Fine Gael in advance claiming credit for what quite possibly could be part of a budget in the autumn. Interestingly, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, most of the opposition, nobody had any great issue with the proposal itself, but it would seem within the government it was all about who was taking credit. Now, I would personally think that it came about largely as an effort to somehow shore up Fine Gael's voter base. There's been some rumblings within that, I think, of late as to what exactly the party stands for, and this was nearly sent out as a reminder, but while that dominated the week, we had other issues. Like, there was more bad news about the climate, but nobody paid any attention to that. And on Friday we heard that there was 12,000 people now who are living in emergency accommodation, and again that was somewhat overshadowed. If you want to sum up what the outcome of the week is, I think Gary Murphy does it very well in the Sunday Times, where he says the battle lines of Irish politics are being redrawn for the next election. Fine Gael will have its tax cutting agenda, no matter how imaginary. The Greens of climate change and the environment. Everybody else will be offering various degrees of left-wing alternatives to the government. And one final thing in relation to what really was thrown up by the week, and that is Fianna Fáil. Now, I have to say, I think...
Were they wrong to kind of fall prey to the bait? Should they just have done what Michael McGrath initially did, was just to say, well, that was really unusual, but try and move it on? Did they fall into a trap that had been laid out for them?
I don't think it was a trap laid out from as such by Fine Gael. I think Michael McGrath is one of the few people to emerge with credit from the whole thing, because he did respond in a moderate fashion, an appropriate fashion. But like, it's indicative of the kind of tensions that are there below the front line. The likes of McGrath and Pascal Donoghue get on very well and what have you. But below the front line, there are certain tensions between the two parties, and it was inevitable that you get some kind of a reaction in that regard. What it does give rise to, though, is the question, again, Gary Murphy mentions it, amid the electoral cocktail, the question remains: what does Fianna Fáil stand for? And I think that is something else that has emerged, that has come to the fore again. It's been popping up a bit of late. What exactly do Fianna Fáil now stand for in what seems to be a certain realignment of Irish politics?
Gráinne, tension between the parties. I see the Greens are perhaps wisely just staying out of it for now. But tension between the parties, or tension within the parties, or a little bit of both?
Well, that's what the papers kind of delve into. And even though just a straightforward run through of what happened during the week is very interesting, getting behind the scenes is even more so. So Hugh O'Connell has a piece in the Sunday Independent where he has a line that, well, two interesting bits. First of all, that the op-ed was fine-tuned by the Fine Gael press office and it's been in the works since late April.
I mean, nothing of that substance goes out without it being cleared, yeah, one assumes, at pretty high levels.
I think that goes to the scale of how coordinated it is, even though the Taoiseach was out yesterday saying that, you know, he's not backing any individual member measures in the budget, and that, you know, he was saying, you know, this is not unusual, it's Fine Gael policy, but there is something.
And and we spoke with Pat Leahy about it yesterday, Gráinne. Obviously, the Taoiseach knew of the contents of it, and certainly after the fact was not resiling from it, he was endorsing
it. But there's no way the Fine Gael press office was fine-tuning it and that they were working on it since late April without completely, you know, a solo run from the party. You know, it does seem like this is the start of an electoral firing gun.
Is it, David, is this, I did ask Pat Leahy this, are we in the kind of the early days, will we look back at this week as the firing off of the unofficial gun of the election, or is it more actually speaking to Fine Gael's ratings, that they seem to maybe feel the need to reassert themselves at this quite early point in an electioneering cycle?
Yeah, it might be that. But really, I think what the ministers were trying to do was trying to keep people standing still. So what do I mean by that? We're quite fortunate in Ireland now that we're poised to have 5% wage growth this year and 5% next year. Those are forecasts by the European Commission. But if you have, let's say, 10% wage growth over 2 years, it means that if the tax bands stay as they are, a lot of people are going to move into the higher rate of tax, and a lot of people are going to get hit a lot harder on income tax, even though they'll be working the same job, they'll still have the cost of living pressures. So Fine Gael were trying to, I suppose, find a voice for those people. Yes, there is politics in that too, but it is also very much about trying to get that policy enacted at the budget. So last year, you know, an average worker was getting about €800 or so of a benefit in the tax changes. What the three ministers were asking for was 1,000, which isn't a massive increase. And I think when you look at the suite of other changes that could have been asked for, so take, for example, the policy to have a 30% middle tax band, or even to lower some of the tax rates, the 20 or the 40%, none of those were pushed at all. This is a relatively moderate and I think, sensible tax change that was actually...
Louise, David's talking about standing still, but most people are running to stand still at the minute in terms of the pressures that they're facing. Are they kind of looking at this spat and just saying this is just...
Absolutely. I mean, Mick mentioned there about the homelessness figures coming out on Friday. And I mean, for the first time, we've 3,596 children in emergency accommodation at the moment, 12,200 in emergency accommodation people. That's the reality for people are facing, and a spat like this does not seem real. We need to get our services in place, and while tax cuts are, you know, there is a squeezed middle there, there absolutely is, but there are people who are struggling to run. And as you mentioned earlier about the 180,000 people applying for exceptional needs payments, that's the reality for some people. 43.5% of lone parent families are experiencing deprivation on a daily basis.
But does it worry you that Fine Gael are that obviously staking this claim to the great myth mystical middle Ireland, but that they're certainly staking his claim in respect of middle income people? Do you think that is actually creating something of a division? Because obviously there are many, many people who are struggling with poverty, including people who have jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. People with jobs are struggling, and absolutely. But I think there is this pitching. I mean, €1,000 tax cuts is less than €20 a week. It's not really going to make a huge difference into people's pockets. That's not really going to be the vote winner I think they think it's going to be. What really needs, what people need, if you're in Ireland, in Middle Ireland, anybody in Ireland at the moment, if you're doing okay, like if you own your own house, if you're in a job, if you're healthy, if your child is healthy, the country's doing well. But if you have any issue at all, and like that, if you're renting, if you have a child with special needs, if you have a health issue yourself, if you're relying on social welfare, people are struggling. And it's only when you need to access services do you realise how badly we are failing certain people in this country.
Is it a spat that has nonetheless worked for Fine Gael? Because I think the Mail on Sunday has a piece which is Advantage Leo despite the Fianna Fáil row.
Yeah, it seems to have. It's gotten people talking about taxes. It's made it look like Fianna Fáil are against this when they're not, to be fair to them. They would probably go along with this because, as I said, last year's tax changes were in agreement with all the parties, and what Fine Gael's asking for isn't a huge step above that. Now, just going back to the whole, Louise makes some excellent points around the people who are really hit out by the cost of living crisis. I think people missed that last week Heather Humphreys called for €10 extra to be given on pensions, carers and disability. That was a public call for budget changes. It's something that, you know, you could argue should have been done privately, but was done publicly. So, you know, this line between keeping all your budget demands public or private look obviously better behind closed doors, but some of them, if they get in the paper,
it's a coalition that the first 3 years, some will say, certainly Pat Lee was saying yesterday, marked by Micheál Martin's whole kind of style of leadership, was kind of consensus, and this does seem to, it feels like a breaking away.
Yeah, it does, and Pat Lee also make a very valid point that saw Micheál Martin ended his term as Taoiseach in a particular way, transition of power, whereas Leo Varadkar will end his with the white heat of a general election. But the other issue that I think arises here is that there's a setting of a tone in terms of the election. Are we back to the scenario, the 2000s, where it's all about tax cuts? Like phrases like the burden of income tax. Now, by comparative standards, we are not highly taxed in this country, including in income tax. There is one large anomaly, and that is the rate at which people go from the standard up into the standard band up into higher. Beyond that, we are not. But if we're going back to that scenario where everything is about tax cuts, I think we're running into serious trouble. And all you have to do is reference the Commission of Taxation last year that said we have to, on the basis of all long-term requirements, we have to increase the tax burden, albeit not an income tax, more on capital and inheritance tax, property tax and that sort of thing. But unless we stand up and realise that, you're going to get into a scenario where we're into this racing about cut tax, and that's the big selling point, as it was in those 2000 elections, but we live in a different world now.
And can I just add, Mick, I think your point is very valid there. And it feels like that the tax income is being used as a bounty for the electoral. You know, it's nearly electioneering, and that's not right. That's our money that we're putting in, and it shouldn't be bountied out to boost any political party. It's our tax money and it should be going where it's needed.
And just on that, Grainne, the polls are just polls. The ultimate poll obviously is an election, but the Business Post does carry a poll which examines the state of the parties. I was just wondering, Mike, maybe just to bring us through some of the headline stats on it.
Yeah, so this is a poll of 1,011 adults age over
18. It's an online poll.
By Red Sea, conducted between Friday 19th and Wednesday the 24th. And it indicates that Sinn Féin, as you mentioned earlier, are up to 34%. So that's an increase of 3 on the last poll.
And that's the margin of error too, isn't it? It's up or down, but yeah,
within
by 3.
The margin of error, yes. And then Fine Gael are on 20%. That's down 2. Fianna Fáil are on 15%. That's down 1. So the Business Post points out that the two largest coalition parties are almost on par with Sinn Féin, according to this poll. The independents are on 11%, the Social Democrats are on 6%, Labour on 4%, which they've been on for quite a while. The Green Party, the other coalition party, are on 4%, down from the electoral 7% they got in the election. PPP, Solidarity are on 3%, and AIM2 are on 1%. So it just indicates, again, if you have to kind of read polls as part of a trend, and then it is again that the coalition parties are they're holding their own on a slight decline, but Sinn Féin are definitely the electoral looking very dangerous electorally, particularly on the back of that win in the local elections in Stormont. They are some kind of very impressive kind of political
a dynamic there. David, the poll is recent, but do you think it captures the spat of the week?
Well, the polling...
The full kind of, I suppose, spectrum of it.
Yeah, so as Grainne mentioned, the polling window is from the prior Friday to the Wednesday, and that op-ed by the three ministers went out on the Monday. So it partially captures it, but also partially doesn't. Now, it is interesting as well that we're slightly off of where the averages have been in the polls recently. Sinn Féin a little higher than they have been in previous polls. The two main parties a little bit lower. Might need to see another poll or two to see whether that's a firmer trend.
But Grainne, just something you were saying there, just on the recent success in Stormont, it's something certainly in Richard Colwell's analysis, he's the chief executive of Red Sea, is just he really just sort of captures that and how it could inform future dynamics here.
Yeah, because, you know, when we're talking about trends and that Sinn Féin win in Northern Ireland and also in the 2020 election in February here, you know, there was the talk of can they replicate it? Can they do it again? And what we saw with the local elections, they very much did. They overtook their own expectations of what they were expecting to get in that election. They got 39 more local election seats than the last time, and they are ahead of the DUP. And I think that that is something that's kind of always rumbling on in the background to any kind of political debate. Like, the Sinn Féin haven't gotten involved in this coalition spat
Say that Mick Clifford, it's the off-lead in the Sunday Times, Mary Lou MacDonald, the Sinn Féin leader, she criticised the coalition over the budget demands and she called it a manufactured distraction from government failings. They're not...
Well, it is a distraction to the extent, yeah, that Fine Gael, as I say, they set out to make a statement there. There's no question about that. And there's definitely true that there have been government failings. And I think Sinn Féin played it very well this week, standing in the background. Of course, Sinn Féin were never going to dispute the proposal because one of their fears is that they'll be labelled as a high tax. And this is a type of fear that Fine Gael put about them. That when Sinn Féin came in, I don't think there's much reason to believe that to be the case. But they certainly, as they do in an awful lot of things, played it very well this week.
Yeah. And what about the Greens, David Higgins? Whether the Greens on this? They just sort of seem to have just perhaps advisedly just sort of stepped out and let them at it.
Yeah, I think that's probably wise on their part. I mean, there's other issues that they're looking into at the minute. I mean, there's a story about a presentation that was made to Fine Gael TDs around farming and land use, and that some of the green policies that are out there might, you know, have an inflationary effect on food prices. So
It's interesting because that private meeting was about an alleged scarcity of land. But Grainne, Daniel Murray, I think in the Business Post, has been saying the Greens want to pay farmers if they return parts of their land to nature.
Yeah, so like when we're talking about tax cuts, the Greens have their own agenda. And I think if it's a case of picking their battles, the Greens are like, we're not weighing in on the tax cut. We want to keep our powder dry for other things. And that this is the kind kind of what comes to mind. So they're saying that the surplus, that massive budgetary surplus that Ireland has and is expected to get for the next few years, should be used to pay farmers to return parts of their land to nature. So farmers could donate, I suppose, well, not donate, to sell their land to the state so that
and they'd be compensated for it.
Exactly. And that surplus, that would be kind of in line with what the government have said it can be used for, and that is a one-off thing and not a recurring payment.
Mick Clifford.
Just a quick thing in terms of the green element. You spoke to Pat Lee, I think, yesterday, Derval, about the Irish Times interview, and I just couldn't help hearing in that Leo Varadkar suggests about the way the different coalition partners laid out their priorities. Mm. And he referenced the Greens as laying out theirs as the 50% reduction in emissions by 2030. Like, saving the planet is not a Green Party agenda. Saving the planet is supposed to be something we're all involved in, from EU level, from global level, all the way down. Sidelining that as, oh, this is a thing for the Greens, I mean, that's an indication of how badly things are being viewed in terms of any efforts to tackle climate change.
Louise, I wonder, was that the spat kind of a waste of valuable political capital? Ger Colleran doesn't hold back in the Irish Mail on Sunday. He says, what exactly did our three amigos, Peter Burke, Martin Aidan and Jennifer Carol McDeal, think the funeral reaction to their piece, to their lovely newspaper opinion piece, would be? He just thought it was a bit of a cheap swipe, that this was sort of pre-electioneering and kind of maybe a waste of valuable political capital. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as Mick said earlier, the two issues of the week are the housing crisis and the climate crisis, and they haven't really been covered to the extent they should be. And I think even the story that we talked about, you know, I know we brushed against it lightly, but 180,000 claims for exceptional needs payment, that shows a real struggling class at the moment.
Is there also, Louise, a bit of a urban-rural divide when it comes to many of the issues, including, you know, the climate agenda in the context of a just transition and the fear that people on lower incomes and those on social support will be left behind?
Absolutely, because even some of the moves the Greens have introduced, which are very progressive, you know, towards retrofitting and all of that, you need an upfront payment to do it in many times. And a lot of families are going to be left out of that. And then because they can't avail of those supports, they end up having to pay more for their electricity, getting more and more into debt.
Yeah, Mick Clifford, was it, you know, and we're coming, silly season seems to get closer and closer each year, but was an example sort of kite flying, or what are the lessons kind of to learn from this when the public are quite maybe agitated about the broader cost of living crisis?
Yeah, it was kite flying, but as I said, to me, it was kind of to reassure the Fine Gael base that potential, perhaps, well, it's certainly not now, but 25% at least of people for whom tax cuts is one of their main political issues. Now, to me, that cohort is shrinking, because once upon a time you could have said it was an older, more middle class demographic. But even that demographic now have adult kids who are paying through the nose for rent and who can't afford to buy a home.
So
it's shrinking even lower than that. Like, and the other thing is, remember, €1,000 a year in terms of tax cuts, what you're talking about for some people, particularly renting in the likes of Dublin, younger people particular, that could be half a month's rent for some people. That's all. Like, so I mean, in terms of priorities and getting things done and affecting change in the widespread common good, I just wonder about it. But there is a cohort there, and that's obviously what they're appealing to.
One of the things, when you think about that €1,000 break and how that spreads across, that it might work out as, you know, €20 per week, additional €20 per week for people, and then you compare about a €10 additional in social welfare measures that has been touted. But that €10, if you gave €20 to someone who's on a lower income, that's going to mean a lot more to them in the middle of a cost of living crisis, when they're saying, you know, that the Taoiseach has admitted that the rate of inflation at which it's going to increase is going down, but it is not going to go back to how it was before it started. So with that in mind, there will need to be permanent changes for those who are on the lowest incomes, single income families, that cohort of people who we have learnt are struggling.
Yeah, and just to even when you're talking about that, that's a really relevant point. The €20 going into the pockets of people who have a little bit more money may not necessarily go into the local economy. It can go on to foreign holidays. It can go into other things. Whereas if you put €20 into the pocket of somebody on low income, it is spent in the local economy and it comes back to the local economy. And that's a really powerful point too. And next week, the Vincentian Partnership issue their report on the minimum essential standard of living. Now, we know already that there's a deficit there for people on social welfare, and it's increasing week on week. And people are managing that by getting into debt, you know, having self-disconnection.
They're not managing it for getting into debt to do so. Before we go to the break, I just want to ask you, David Higgins, was there a sense of brand management or brand differentiation, a sort of testing of messages? Because, you know, Fine Gael have come, or the Taoiseach has come out very far as a follow-up to the SPAT to say we want, you know, to increase more housing, home ownership, seeming to kind of put a bit of a fork as if to say, well, Fianna Fáil are concentrating on social housing, and the Taoiseach saying, well, we need a little bit of both, but we need that more. So is there a kind of a real question of brand differentiation, even as we are, whether it's November 2024 or summer before March 25?
Yeah, I'd say yes, there is. And there is a bit of a movement within Fine Gael for that. So there was a Fine Gael event yesterday. It was commemorating 100 years of Conan Gael.
You were at it?
I was at it, yeah. And talking to some members there.
You're a member?
Yeah, you're a member.
Fine Gael.
So the member I got talking to, he said, look, his wife is one of those people who gets up early in the morning. She gets a train from Limerick Junction up to Dublin to work in a Dublin hospital. Train leaves before 6 a.m. So that kind of cohort is a cohort that Fine Gael is trying to reach out to. So yes, it is brand differentiation, if you want to call it that. But it's also talking to those voters and saying, look, Fine Gael has your back.
Okay, well, listen, we will take a quick break there. Lots and lots of messages coming in contesting a lot of what you had to say this morning. We might get a few of those. We'll just take a very, very quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back. Just a reminder, David Higgins, Grainne Nia, Louise Bayliss and McClifford are with me in studio this morning. Grainne, I just want to go, there's a quite interesting piece by, I think it's Killian Woods, mm-hmm. in the Business Post about civil servants complaining of being sidelined by ministers. But it's not an unattributed story. It's quite a robust one.
Yeah, it's an official report compiled by the Paris-based group, the OECD. And it's a review of policy making in Ireland by this group. So what they are told by a group of civil servants is that they have a number of concerns about how policy is enacted, and they feel that they are rushed, and that there is an increasing focus on political communication and achievability rather than policy. And they also warn that there is a possibility of a loss of institutional memory because a huge group of civil servants are due to retirement. They call it a retirement cliff, and that there is going to be kind of this loss of knowledge of kind of how to do things about official processes, that because this group are retiring. But one of the things they say that is really interesting, they talk about formality, the formal way of doing these things, that this is kind of being overtaken by unsuitable, informal or ad hoc practices that are being relied upon. Informal agreements, discussions and decisions taken at meetings are not always consistently recorded. So it's really quite powerful.
I thought it was interesting, you know, McClifford, because the OECD, who had been asked by the government actually for help in actually improving government's ability to develop and respond to policies, the OECD says there's pressure at times from ministers to fast-track policies without adequate analysis and advice, which end up being hard to implement or have the undesired side effects. This is not just a spat between civil servants and ministers.
Oh, I think it's a really, really interesting piece because it goes to the heart of, you know, a lot of complaints, particularly about the current government, but it's a more wider thing going back, is deliverability, the ability to get things done, to do things, to do the basic things properly. We know governments are very good in emergency situations, not the housing, they don't consider that proper emergency, but you know what I mean? Ukraine, pandemic. Yes, they operate very well when backs are to the wall. But this business of doing the grind, the daily stuff, day in, day out, and this really highlights one of the issues that arise. And one quote that I thought really came to it is that the political government considered the senior civil servants and within departments to be simply one view alongside others within and outside the system proffering advice. So in other words, those outside the system effectively lobby groups, everything from construction industry, right to industry, right down to various sectors, lobby groups having a major input into policy.
And also, David Higgins, just on that, about the reliance or the use of outside consultancies to inform policy, and the civil servants kind of just say, no, their process might be slower, but actually, why are you not seeking that expertise from within? And a warning that a lack of official records could also pose a risk in the event of future judicial reviews, high court decisions being taken.
Well, I think the use of external consultants is broadly a good thing. I know it's a controversial area.
You would say that being an economist.
I know. Well, look, I don't. Look, I work for a small firm. We don't do that kind of work. But the reason I think it's good, if you go back to COVID and when we had to get everyone vaccinated and all the digital systems we had to get going, it was one of the consulting firms that came in and did that externally. It wasn't internal HSC people. We now have this story in Cork University Hospital of external consultants being brought in, trying to drive through process management, different changes. Yes, at a high expense, but it's one of the most overcrowded hospitals, so I think it needs that. And now the unions are not engaging with that, which is an unfortunate turn of events. But I think a bit of external input into a system like the civil service is needed. There's a balance to be struck there,
but
too.
But that sense of being rushed, because as one of the other things they say, Louise Bayliss, is that the emergence of the 24-hour media cycle was blamed by some of those surveyed for creating challenges in the uptake of policy advice by politicians. You know, in an age where we live in a perma-crisis, arguably, and have done perhaps for some time, there's huge pressures on the system, and yet we expect decisions that are taken that are deliberated and are taken time over. So there's a tension there.
No, absolutely, there's a tension. And, you know, I think in the main, I think most civil servants who are dealing with policy are actually very good at their job. They're very good. I mean, I work in advocacy, so, you know, between Focus Ireland and National One Parent Family Alliance.
You deal with a lot of these officials.
I'm meeting with officials all the time. And in general, I find that they're very good at policy and they really get the points. They are, you know, working to that. And then a minister will come along, even though you've given a very reasoned example why this needs to happen, the civil servants are agreeing with you, and, you know, a budget decision is made 2 days before a budget's announced, and the whole policy falls down because it's not funded or it's not given the precedence, things like that. So I think civil servants, they do need to be respected for the work they're doing, and while ministers absolutely have the democratic mandate to make the decisions, they do need to use the expertise and make sure that what they're implementing is actually going to work out.
And growing, your institutional memory matters, doesn't it? I mean, that notion of a retirement cliff is perhaps something we maybe didn't quite realise the extent of it, but it is being flagged by the OECD as an issue.
Yeah, definitely, because I think it's a mix of, you know, one of the things David was saying there about the importance of consultancy. I think on most issues there should be a mix of different viewpoints or different processes, and it's just about making sure that one does not override the other. But on that same point, you need a mix of like experienced older people who have been through crises before, who know how to respond to them, who said, we actually tried that before and it didn't work out, or there is an issue with approaching that particular topic that way, or I know someone who could help us out with that. All of that is invaluable and hard to save or to distill through, you know, automated processes or anything like that. But I also think it just it struck me as well that some things just take time. You know, we're always pushing ministers to say, when is this going to happen? What is going to be done about that? And I think that's fair enough on a lot of things, but sometimes policies just take longer to implement.
And take consultation. Let's take a wee break from domestic matters and go to Enda Brady in London to talk about the this morning host Holly Willoughby has come out last night saying it was very hurtful to find out that her co-host Philip Schofield lied about his affair at work with a much younger man. Enda, we're to tell us I suppose the answer we may know already, is this the end of Philip Schofield's career?
Yeah, look, I think there's no coming back from this. I think the only person in Britain right now who thinks he has any broadcasting future is Schofield himself. Look, he'll probably pop up somewhere at some stage, but in terms of having the power, the influence and the contracts that he's previously had for the last two decades, it's game over. I mean, there's not going to be any more mainstream morning TV with millions of viewers and all of the love and affection that he previously had. I mean, I think his reputation is toast right now.
And talk to us about Holly Willoughby. You know, she came out last night with a statement talking about her huge sense of betrayal, that she was lied to, that she did question him about it, and that he denied it. What about her future prospects?
I think she's kind of bulletproof. I think the public love her. She comes across as very warm and sincere and genuine, like a girl next door type. She's a brilliant presenter. Everyone likes her. She's extremely popular. And I think, you know, my reading of it in the last few days, I think while his reputation has absolutely plummeted and I don't see any way back for him in mainstream TV, I think, look, Holly Willoughby is immensely popular. She's a brand. She's a name. She's a reputation. And she's very, very popular across the United Kingdom. So I think she will keep going. ITV will want to really lock her in and keep her. And I think she will have come out with this with her reputation intact because, you know, she stood by him when he came out 3 years ago, when he announced on the sofa one morning that he was gay. She held his hand. They'd been on holidays as families. I mean, they were extremely close, but I do get the impression all of that is now over.
And can I talk to you just about the ITV executives, because the focus has now pivoted to those. They have said that that they did investigate the issue, but that both parties originally denied any affair. If they did so, did that put them in a difficult position as an employer?
I think if I was running ITV today, I'd be asking some serious questions about who was in charge of that investigation and just how willing they were to accept Schofield's word for what happened. So, yeah, I would imagine, look, it wouldn't surprise me if some deputy heads must roll, is always the phrase, if that happens in the next week or so. But, I mean, ITV will not be happy. Their name, their brand being dragged through the media, all of the headline coverage, all of the online commentary. I mean, they will be very, very angry about Schofield lying to them. And, you know, the statement he put out the other day was that he wanted to host the National Soap Awards. He'd see people in a couple of weeks' time, and there were other big projects lined up for him. Look, from everything industry insiders and people inside ITV have been telling me, this was fantasy land and it was only ever going to end one way, and that was with Schofield leaving the building.
And obviously Schofield has left the building, and it's your view that Holly Willoughby is safe, but there's a lot of analysis and speculation, and particularly in the UK papers this morning, wondering, can actually this morning, this show that he fronted for 20 years, can it itself survive, or will it suffer a News of the World style, you know, just being removed completely because the brand is so tainted, even if Holly Willoughby is not?
No, I think the show will continue. It has to continue for ITV because it's such a big slot. It's such a revenue generator as well.
So was News of the World, Enda. So was News of the World.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, that's true. But I think this is very different to what was going on at the News of the World. This is just one individual who has caused them a massive headache. So I think, look, not comparing the News of the World with this morning, but I think this morning mostly has a very wholesome reputation. And that's what people bought into. With Schofield, he was seen as this ideal family man, smiley guy on TV, really charming. He was presenting awards. He made an absolute mint out of ITV off the back of a clean, wholesome reputation. And now the truth has come out. I think it's him that is the problem, and not this morning. I think the show's a great concept. They've got good presenters. They get great talent in to talk about their albums, their records, their TV shows, their books. You know, it's a very, very popular couple of hours of broadcasting, and I think it will continue with Holly Willoughby. She'll get a new, presumably male TV husband beside her, and I think the show will go on.
Well, there you have it from London-based journalist Enda Brady. The show will go on. Thanks a million, Enda. Thanks for joining us this morning. It's coming up to 11:43. Let's take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very, very welcome back to the programme. Okay, one issue that is quite prominent across all of the newspapers is refugees, including Grania. It's a second part of that Red Sea poll, just in respect of, they polled, again, the same number of people online about issues relating to the refugee crisis, and in particular, the increased number of people who have come to Ireland as a result of the Ukraine war.
Yeah, so the headline is 3/4 think Ireland are taking in too many refugees. So the poll indicates that 75% said they don't think, or they think the number of refugees Ireland is taking in is now too many, is the phrasing of the question.
One of a number of questions, though, that was asked by it, because it kind of gets McClifford a little bit more nuanced, you know. A similar number of people appreciate some of the anger people feel about asylum seekers being moved into the local area, but it drops significantly when they ask the question, I would be concerned about asylum seekers being relocated to my local area. It drops to 55, and then and interestingly, just under 50%, 49% said they weren't happy about the state's failure to provide accommodation for all asylum seekers who arrive here. So it shows the complexity.
I have some sympathy with the government in relation to housing people, because it is a serious job, and the notion that 75% of people think we're taking in too many. Yes, if times were ordinary, absolutely we would be taking in too many when you look at the volume. But times are not ordinary. There's a war going on in Europe, and something like 70-80% of those coming in are as a result of that war, and that's what's creating all the pressures.
Yeah, and
if Putin's aim was to try to destabilise Europe, well, in some ways he may be getting towards it because of this, but we have obligations as well, you know?
Yeah, and of course we can't cap the number. Grainne, one of the things you mentioned earlier about polls is that we need to read them as part of a trend, and I wonder, can it really indicate part of a trend in circumstances where the population has increased as a result of a very, very specific intervention, namely the Ukraine war?
Yeah, I was thinking about this morning. The context of this is that we are in a massive housing crisis that the public are only too aware of, and that the governments have been struggling to address for the guts of more than 10 years now. And I think an anger from that is definitely evident in those answers as well. The part of what Mick mentioned there is we have an international obligation to house people who are claiming asylum, and that there is a certain minimum standard to that. The other part of this is that,
in fact, one of the senior EU officials was warning that the failure to do so, the failure to provide that accommodation, could itself feed anti-migrant kind of far-right tendencies.
But one of the things as well is that I think it just shows that, you know, the Taoiseach mentioned yesterday he doesn't understand the whole COVID-style response, what is meant by that. I think part of it is solidarity, getting a kind of an understanding from the public that we are committed to this and this is how we're going to go about doing it. And there is a communications issue there.
Well, that's something actually that was identified by, actually think probably one of the most nuanced pieces on the issue this morning is in the Irish Mail Sunday, where a former senior Gardaí who had worked in the Garda Diversity Unit, he pointed out, you know, that we've had a population increase of less than 1% in 96 to 17% of people who are born outside of Ireland, and that's largely, David Higgins, been marked by extraordinary social cohesion. And he was making the point that, you know, that what keeps cohesion in society is communicating with people, because if you don't, that's when people will react, and that's when it starts to look like a racist protest. And that is, I should get the gentleman's name
Dave
there.
Dave McInerney.
Yeah. He headed the the Garda Diversity Unit.
Yeah,
so is it that? Is it perhaps just a failure to communication?
I think absolutely there's a lack of communication there. And I think there's so many people who are marginalised. And I work every day with marginalised people, be they lone parents living in poverty or people experiencing homelessness. And they are very marginalised. And they're very ripe for being brought into a conversation that may not be the conversation they want to be in. And I think the far right have been very clever in targeting people who are marginalised and bringing them in. And absolutely, it can seem very much that, you know, middle class people sit and talk about the refugee crisis, but they're not coming into their areas. And these marginalised groups of people can feel pushed even further. And I suppose if you're looking at, you know, you're 10 years on a social housing list and you see an extra 80,000 people coming in the country, does that mean you're being pushed down? It doesn't. But is the government communicating that strongly enough? I don't think they are. And I think Dave McInerney's piece is extremely nuanced and really getting that people generally have been very accepting of other nationalities coming into the country. We're a welcoming, open in society. There's extreme pressures on resources. But there is enough for everybody, but it's not being communicated strongly enough.
Well, I mean, one element to that, though, as well, I mean, Louise, right, in terms of marginalised people, but there's another sector as well that's being disproportionately impacted, and that is the Western Seaboard and the whole tourist economy there. And in the Business Post today, Paul Kelly, the head of Fáilte Ireland, suggests that the biggest issue in tourism today is the influx of people fleeing war, persecution and seeking asylum in Ireland. And that is impacting, and we like places like Clare, and you see this, and actually proportionately there are far more people staying in the Western Seaboard than by a huge measure than even in Dublin or the major conurbations. But you see a scenario there whereby it's not just people having to adjust to a change in their society, but for a lot of people it's impacting on their livelihood, because there's no tourism. The property owners are doing fantastic out of it, but all the ancillary services, because
made David Higgins in that point, because look, I'm sure there was a point of time at which hotels might have been happy to have been provided with that initial support, and obviously the tourism industry is back up and open, but that kind of notion that there people are being disproportionately housed in the hotel sector, which has a knock-on effect on other services such as restaurants or other tourist offerings within an area.
Yeah, so the point the Fáilte Ireland chief here makes is that
what paper was that in again?
That's the Business Post. Yeah, so if you have boarded up shops on a street, that can wreck the image of a town. And boarded up restaurants and shops and amusements and other services could be what you end up with if you have prolonged summers on end, summers after summer, with the hotels still being taken in with refugees. I mean, of the 80,000 Ukrainian refugees that have come to Ireland, they note that 47,000 of those are being housed in hotels, which is an astronomically large proportion of them.
Yeah, and within that, David, the government, and it's not the first one, because this has been examined all across the European continent, the government has signalled that it's examining the use of so-called floating hotels or flotels as an option that could be used to house international protection applicants. I think the point that Paul Kelly, who's the Chief Executive of Fáilte Ireland, has made is just that that it's, you know, obviously COVID shut down the tourism sector very quickly, but it's quite hard to reopen that again. It's not just something that you just sort of, you know, turn a light on and it's there.
It is, yeah, because what I would say is that the hotels themselves kind of did switch off and on during COVID, right? So I don't think that's a huge issue. But it is the whole issue of boarded up restaurants and stuff on streets. Mm. If they shut down because they don't have the business this summer, will they reopen next summer? Will they be, I guess, a little bit scarred by the experience of having lost the business this year? That's a major risk that's out there.
Yeah, Louise Billis, the notion of flotels might be horrific to some, but so also is the prospect of, you know, living in a tent and being threatened online or elsewhere with that being shut down.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree that living on tent is not ideal, but I don't think putting people on a flotel is the answer either. I mean, we've seen, you know, where people are being housed in you know, hotels that are isolated from everywhere, and tensions mount up, where you're putting people who are coming from different cultural backgrounds and doing, I think, put it, and that's because they're in areas where there's no services, there's nothing to do, just sit in a hotel together. I think putting people in a flotel like that and having them so alienated from society is just a recipe for disaster, future disaster.
This is where some of the concern over, you know, the poll today shows, I think it was 55% or so of people saying they would be concerned if asylum seekers moved into their area. I mean, I would answer no to that question, but the people who are concerned might be looking at the fact that we're now down to the lower standards of accommodation. And if you put anybody, if you put the 160 or so members of the Dáil in substandard accommodation, some of them would end up being a bit, you know, a bit kind of in a worse state for it because of that.
And yeah, but is it there, McClifford, just to remind ourselves of the scale of the crisis that we're facing in terms of that increase in the population? It is not, as I say, we've managed migration quite well, but the scale of the challenge, and we aren't even, some might say, on the front line of this crisis.
We're not in the front line, but of those countries, not physically on the front line, we're to the fore in terms of the way we've been.
Would you support the use of flotels or?
Nobody
would like them.
It's a dropping of standards, but I suppose the big thing is this: it is far better than tents. And if it's a scenario whereby it's a temporary situation, for example, if this was necessary, would it be possible that the reception centres could be used as the flotels if these are transient hubs from which people are sent elsewhere? Like, for instance, just off, say, the ticks and likes of City West, supposing that was a more permanent scenario and you had the transient hubs in the flotels. If it's a short-term solution, it's possible. Unfortunately, we've seen in other areas, something that begins as a short-term solution ends up being a permanent one. But
like direct provision itself.
Well, that's true. That temporary measure.
Which the government have committed to phasing out when they went into coalition together. And now they're considering another policy that is very similar.
Can I bring you back to that, because Richard Caldwell, who is the CEO of Red Sea, which conducted the online poll, in his analysis, he's saying, you know, that that certainly the issue of immigration has become far more important to political fortunes of the government parties than it once was. Mm. More consultation and understanding are key, as well as perhaps a greater focus on the positive contribution of asylum seekers and immigrants generally to the wider Irish society.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when the Taoiseach is asked about this, he says that there, when we think about the scale of the crisis, 100,000 asylum seekers, Ukrainian nationals coming to Ireland, and the level of protest that we have seen that people have been kind of expressing concerns about, it is small in comparison to that number when you think about it. But I think the government need to support the local community efforts. You know, one of the problems, I think, is that communities that are already lacking certain services, GPs, schools,
which is the point
transport.
That Louise makes at yeah. this, we can't divorce this from the context of the general cost of living crisis, which in many respects, Louise Bayliss, is about access to services.
Absolutely, it's access to services. You know, if you have, there's, I'm just thinking of an example of a lone parent I was speaking to recently. She had no electricity in her house, and the reason she had no electricity in her house for 2 weeks was because she had a child going into secondary school in September. The child had special needs. She'd been 3 years on a waiting list to get an early assessment, and she ended up having to pay for it privately out of her own money. And by paying for it privately, she ended up getting her electricity cut off and literally struggling. So I think when we talk about services, sometimes we talk about services and it seems like it's out there, but it costs people money when there's a lack of services. And it costs, obviously, everybody in the state. You know, it's, as I said earlier, I think the country's really doing well if you're healthy and well and whatever. But if you have any type of thing where you need access to services, be it a GP, even at the moment, like, for instance, I had a bad chest a couple of weeks ago. I phoned up my GP. It was 5 days to get an appointment. So, this is the reality.
Some out there might say, lucky you, only 5 days. Can I just bring to Grania, just up the culture, right, before we finish up, the nation's favourite optimist, Luke O'Neill, is saying that we can harness our dreams to boost our brain power. What's that all about?
I love these kind of... So basically the premise of the piece, I can't find it now, but the premise of the piece is basically that if you dream, you have the capacity to come up with creative solutions better than if you don't. So there was this analysis done, and as people were dozing off, researchers suggested the word trees to them. Then they were likely to dream about trees in different ways. But then when they woke up, they asked them to come up with, you know, kind of creative ideas. And the ones that had were told trees and had dreamt about that came up with these much more imaginative ideas than those who had no dreams at all or who were not prompted. So the idea is that, and he links this to other creative types who come up with songs in their sleep. For example, Paul McCartney came up with Yesterday and it woke up and he's like, that must be a song I've heard before. And the other Beatles were like, no, I think
you
just made that up.
If you dream it, you can be it.
I've been a dreamer all my life there, believe me.
If we dream about the tax bans going up, that means it might
happen. Oh, no, please.
No, I actually, Luke is just so weird. He just always just sort of kind of bring these interesting things. But it's based on a study that was carried out at Massachusetts Institutes of Technology involving 50 students and their professors. Some stayed awake, some stayed awake, and they closed their eyes and relaxed and then came up and thought about all these things. So it's a nice thing to end dreams. I'm going to get the production team to dream about tea, perhaps, over... the next 20, 30 or 30 seconds or so, and I know it's going to appear after the break. But before we go to the news, I just want to thank our newspaper panel, David Higgins, economist at Carraghill, Gráinne, a Dublin reporter with the Press Association, to Louise Bayliss, campaign coordinator of Focus Ireland and founding member of Spark, which is the Lone, Great Lone Parents Association, also to Mick Clifford, special correspondent for the Irish Examiner. Thank you to all of you for sharing your dreams with us this morning.